Okay, so it's now 2 o'clock, and if it's okay with everyone, I'd like to call this meeting to order. First thing we're going to do is we need to approve the agenda. So I need a call for a motion to approve the agenda.
So moved.
Second?
Second.
Any discussion about the agenda? All those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposed? Okay, the agenda is approved. Now we need to do approval of minutes. Everyone got those before they got sent them. Is there any changes to the minutes? Or does anyone have any questions about the minutes? I'll take a motion for approval.
So moved.
Second?
Second.
Okay. Any further discussion or any changes? Okay. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Okay. The minutes are approved as written. Now, consent agenda. All items listed under the consent agenda will be enacted by one motion. There will be no separate discussion of these items unless a request is made prior to the time the board votes on the motion. So the first thing we have is, or the only thing on the consent agenda, is the consideration of the fiscal year 20 grants to counties contract effective July 1st to June 30th. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, and that passes. Okay, now the public forum. This is a time for members of the public to offer comments concerning matters not scheduled to be heard before the Board of Health. Are there any members who wish to speak? Nope. Okay, and we will move on. So now, further items. Medical cannabinoidal in Iowa presentation by Randy Meyer. This will be an interesting one.
I say cannabidiol.
Cannabidiol? Did I say that right?
Cannabidiol or cannabidiol are both correct pronunciations.
Okay. Thank you.
So I'm happy to be here to give you a quick update on Iowa's medical cannabidiol program.
Could you introduce yourself again for the minutes?
I am Randy Mayer. I am the chief of the Bureau of HIV, STD, and Hepatitis, and also director of the Office of Medical Cannabidiol at the Iowa Department of Public Health. I would also be happy to come back. So we need to sit?
It should pick you up if you don't want
okay.
to.
I would also be happy to come back sometime to talk about some of the things happening with HIV and hepatitis and some of the work we're doing there as well. But I'm going to stick to the Office of Medical Cannabidiol here. This is a brief, very brief overview. We are going around giving presentations to public health administrators, to physicians groups, to nurses, to hospital systems, anybody who wants to know a little bit more about how the program is working, how you become a patient, what the roles of physicians are in the program. And keeping in mind that it's likely to be updated this year by the legislature, so we expect a bill to come out pretty soon to change a little bit of this. So in May of 2017, the legislature passed Iowa Code 124E, which provides that someone may possess, use, dispense, deliver, transport, or administer medical cannabidiol, and I will define that in just a second because it's pretty unique to the state of Iowa. As long as all of those things are consistent with the code as it was passed and the rules that we've since put into place. And the Iowa Department of Public Health was charged to regulate the program and to set it up. So medical cannabidiol in Iowa, and that's specific because no other state works this way, is defined as any pharmaceutical grade cannabinoid. So cannabidiol is CBD. So for those of you who purchase products over the counter, CBD is cannabidiol. That is one cannabinoid. Nevertheless, the legislature defined cannabinoid or cannabidiol in Iowa as any cannabinoid or any mixture of cannabinoids. That were extracted from the plant Cannabis sativa L or Cannabis indica, any preparation of cannabinoids that has a tetrahydrocannabinol or THC level of no more than 3%. That also makes us unique. No other state has a 3% cap on their THC. There are some states that have slightly higher caps, but most states do not have any caps on their THC. And the way that we measure 3% is by weight in either milligrams per milliliter if it's a liquid, or milligrams per gram if it's a solid. And so they, we were charged with having two manufacturers who would make medical cannabidiol defined this way and deliver it in a form recommended by our medical cannabidiol board that was established by the governor. And then the forms had to be approved by the Board of Medicine, and then they were put into administrative rule by the Board of Health. So you see there are quite a number of boards that are involved, a lot of physician oversight to the program in our state. So essentially the components of the law and what we were charged to do was convene the Medical Cannabidiol Board, which was appointed by the governor, and I'll talk a little bit about that. Issue patient and primary caregiver registration cards, license two manufacturers, license five in-state dispensaries, establish fees for patients, caregivers, manufacturers, and dispensaries, monitor the manufacturing and dispensing of the products, and then the law itself also provides some legal protections for patients, caregivers, physicians, and their attorneys who might be involved in this. So, just to define who a patient in Iowa is, it means anyone with one of our qualifying debilitating medical conditions. They can be of any age, but they have to be a permanent resident of Iowa. They cannot have been convicted of a disqualifying felony offense related to the possession, use, or distribution of a controlled substance. Minors can be a part of the program, and there are a couple of debilitating conditions that include minors. But they actually do not get cards themselves, and they cannot go and purchase. So they have to have a caregiver who purchases on their behalf. To become a patient or to qualify, you need to print off our healthcare practitioner form. So the healthcare practitioner form is certifying by a physician that the person is eligible for the program. So they have one of the debilitating medical conditions. You complete a patient application. We have an online or a paper application. You send that in to us or upload it along with a copy of an ID. And the payment is $100 unless you qualify for SSI, SSDI, or Medicaid. And then your fee is $25 per year. So every year you have to requalify. You have to reapply because your condition may have changed. So your physician has to say that, in fact, you still qualify for the program, and then you pay an additional $100 or $25 if you meet the reduced fee. You don't have to, but you can have a primary caregiver. The only ones that have to are minors. So a primary caregiver is a resident of Iowa or one of the contiguous states, someone who's at least 18 years of age. And you're either a legal guardian or you have been designated by a provider, a medical provider, a physician, to care for that patient. So you need a certification form signed by the physician as well, saying that this person is a reasonable person to be a care provider for that person. And really, by care provider, we mean somebody who would administer, go and purchase the medication, bring it back, and administer it to a person. So somebody might not be ambulatory, they might not be able to get to a dispensary, they might be a minor, something like that. So they can have somebody else go and purchase on their behalf. They also have to fill out an application on a yearly basis, but the fee is $25 for that. So Iowa is also fairly unique in having our cards issued by the Department of Transportation. So you get it at a driver's license station, and it looks very much like a driver's license. So once all the information comes to us and we approve somebody as having qualified and they pay their fee, we send that information to the DOT, and then you go to a driver's license station and get your card, and it looks just like this. So one is the top one is a primary caregiver card, and the bottom one is a patient card. You then take that card to one of our five dispensaries, and that's what allows you to purchase the products. So here are the 13 qualifying conditions that we currently have. There were originally nine, but there is a process to add conditions, and so our board can hear petitions from the public to add other conditions. If they approve one of those petitions, that goes to the Board of Medicine. The Board of Medicine also has to approve that, and then it gets put into rule by the Board of Medicine. So there have been four conditions that have been approved by both boards and added. There have been a number of conditions that have been approved by the Medical Cannabidiol Board, but they have been denied by the Board of Medicine as well. So cancer, as long as the condition or treatment produces chronic pain, nausea, or severe wasting, multiple sclerosis, seizure disorder, HIV, Crohn's disease, ALS, or amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, then any terminal illness with a probable life expectancy under 1 year, as long as you have those three symptoms, Parkinson's disease, and then the most common one is untreatable pain. So any pain whose cause cannot be removed and according to generally accepted medical practice, the full range of pain management modalities appropriate for the patient have been tried without adequate result with intolerable side effects. Our board has talked about changing, and in fact, there was a petition to change this definition, and the board approved that to just say chronic pain and leave it at that. This definition sort of implies that you have to try opioids, and then you have to fail on those. And our board has said openly they don't think that is required, and that if you don't want to try opioids but want to try this instead, that you still would meet the definition of untreatable pain, but that would really be up to your medical provider to determine and to certify you. So the ones that have been added are ulcerative colitis, severe intractable pediatric autism with aggressive or self-injurious behaviors, corticobasal degeneration, and then sort of a modification to the severe intractable autism, and that is really taking the pediatric out of that. So anybody with severe intractable autism with aggressive or self-injurious behaviors. We currently have about 5,000 patients now, and you can see that we get about 400 applications that we approve every month, just to give you a sense of how large the program is. When the program was originally set up, the Legislative Services Administration estimated that there would be about 6,000 patients, they thought, in Iowa that might qualify for the program, and we're about 5,000 right now. Of course, that's going to depend on whether there are changes in the conditions or other conditions that are added over time. I will say that there's also considerable attrition from the program, so there are a number of people who use it for a short time and then don't renew or stop purchasing as well. Just to make it clear what the role of the physician is, they do not prescribe, and it's very hard to get physicians to say that they do not prescribe. No matter how much I talk to them, they still say, well, when I prescribe. So they are not prescribing, they are not even recommending, and they have no role in setting dosing recommendations for their patients. What they are doing is qualifying them for the program. So they're certifying that, in fact, they meet the eligibility for the program. They certainly are welcome to work with the patients on dosing, on talking to patients about what's working and what's not, but the program has not been set up that way at this point, at least. So they're not required to do that. What they do is certify that they have a relationship with the patient, that they are certifying that the patient has one of qualifying debilitating conditions. They provide them with educational material, which they get off of our website. So we provide the educational material. They just have to download it and discuss it with the patient. So it talks about risks and benefits of medical cannabidiol, as well as contraindications to use. They agree to recertify the patient each year and then to provide information to the department should we need it. Within the law, there are a number of protections for physicians, and because I'm often speaking to physicians, I include this in my presentations, maybe not as important in this presentation, but just to let you know that there are some legal protections for physicians from their Board of Medicine taking action against them or law enforcement taking action against them. There's already some legal precedent that DEA registrations are not in jeopardy for participating in the program. And there have been no malpractice cases against physicians who have participated in medical cannabis programs across the United States to date.
How can that be that you, because the DEA is a federal agency, and in general, the more restrictive rules apply?
So
the DEA still considers this a Schedule I drug.
So if you look at, because you're not prescribing it, although in some states you are prescribing it, so there are a number of states that actually have physicians as prescribers. Our program is not set up that way. But it's if you look at the case law that's up there, that the Conant versus Walters, it really was about, does a physician have a right to say that they recommend or that they think that use of cannabis would help a patient? And certainly that is within the right of a physician to have that discussion with a patient, and that discussion is protected. And so because that's really what we're asking you to do, is have a discussion with the patient about whether cannabis use would be right for them, you're protected in that.
So in the past, we used to have a physician card that we applied for that we could prescribe it or use it. That is no longer the case. That now it sounds like what happens is the patients actually just need us to say, yes, they have debilitating pain.
That's right.
And that CBD products may help.
That's right.
But we have to say that the CBD in that application process, say that we feel that CBD may help.
You don't have to say that. What you have to say is that they qualify. So if they do, so you're certifying that this is your patient. Number one, this is your patient. Number two, they have this condition. And number three, you agree to provide information to the department should we need it. So that's really all you're saying.
How do they know how much to take?
The manufacturer is really who has been put in charge of sort of working out what would be the right dosing for patients. So I think that, the 3% THC was sort of an idea that they probably were not going to be harmed by the level of THC that is in the product. It certainly has enough THC that it can be psychoactive, so don't misunderstand to say that 3% THC is not psychoactive. It actually can be. It really depends on the severity of your symptoms and the amount of pain that you have and the amount that you take. So, but the manufacturer is who has been authorized really by the legislature to develop the products and then to make recommendations as to how to use those products. And so that's the way that it's worked.
So I just want to make sure I'm right on this. So the state says is the people who are going to be making money by, if you take more, are deciding how much to give you.
That's right. And I will also say that one of the medical cannabidiol board's recommendations is to have pharmacists involved. So they would like to have a pharmacist at the dispensary who is there to help patients with that. And there are some states that do it that way. Certainly Minnesota is a very similar program to ours, and they have pharmacists who are required to be there to discuss use of the products and contraindications and other, kinds of things. And we do not have that built into the program, but it is a recommendation from our board, and they've recommended it before as well. So that is something we're waiting to see.
Medical practitioner, the pharmacist, right? I mean,
that's right.
Not a physician, so what are the complications here? Implications.
Exactly. Well, that's kind of the way a medical cannabis program has to run in a state, although, again, I will say there are at least two states that allow physicians to set the dosing recommendations and to actually prescribe. And so far, there have been no actions taken against any physicians in those states as well. So there are other models, but I think the idea was to protect the physicians and to try to get them to be involved in the program, and so to put as many protections in place as they could for physicians. Again, we were not the designers of the program. We are just the implementers. So.
This is very tough. Iowa is trying very hard to do this appropriately and in a very tough issue with no real medical data yet.
Yeah.
And hopefully as more of this is done, we will actually start to get some data. And
and stuff. It's a tough situation in many respects. Because I remember the information you sent us, one of the things that you discuss is the issue that studies have to be done.
Right.
I was just at a conference, a national conference, and a researcher came up again and said, I'd love to study this stuff, but I can't because it's a Schedule I drug. And I don't have a license to study Schedule I drugs, no matter what any state tells me, because my money comes from the federal government.
And then one university makes all the products available, or makes cannabis available, so there's only really one type of cannabis, so it's not really very similar to a lot of the products that we have available either, so that a lot of the research that's being done in the U.S. isn't really going to be very useful or informative for the types of products that we make available in each of these state programs. So,
I was reading in your report that the industry made over $2 million, and there were about 600 patients. So that was done. The dosage was prescribed by the pharmacist?
Or? No. So there's really nobody's so it's really the manufacturer has given recommendations to the dispensaries. The dispensaries has trained their staff on those recommendations. So when you go in, what they do is usually a sort of intake for the patient. So what medications are you on? What are your conditions? How, you know, what's the severity of those? Then based on that, they say, well, then these would be the products that we would suggest. They're, I think, very good at saying we want you to start at a very low dose, whether it's CBD or THC, and I'll show you what the products are that we have. And then go for at least 10 days on that before you decide that you need more, or it's not working, or you want something else. So it's sort of start low and then try moving up over some period of time. It's essentially.
So the personal physician monitors the patient?
Only if the patient wants that to be. So if the patient reaches out to a physician to talk to them about that, they can do that. If a physician said, I'm only going to certify you if, you know, if we are going to discuss this, that would be one way to do it. But no, there is no interaction between the physician or the patient unless they've agreed on that in some way.
Yeah, this whole thing is designed to protect physicians.
Yeah.
That's how it's designed.
Yeah.
Randy, this is a great, great talk, but we do have a lot of things we have to do on our agenda.
Okay.
If we could try to kind of complete it in the next couple of minutes, I'd really appreciate it.
Sure.
Okay.
So let me just talk a little bit about the five dispensaries that we have. They are spread across the state in Sioux City, Council Bluffs, Des Moines, Waterloo, and Davenport, run by three different companies. Here are the forms that have been approved by the Board of Medicine and the Medical Cannabinoid Board. So we have oral forms. The ones in blue are the ones that we have available right now, capsules, tinctures. There's a lotion. There's also now a vaporizable form that's new. And then there are nobody right now is making suppositories, but that would also be allowed. Nothing can be edible, and nothing can be in food, and nothing can be combusted. Here, the last slides are just sort of what the products look like. So this is MedFarm's products. They make tinctures, capsules, a vaporizable form in lotions. They make them in these different strengths. So they're ratios of CBD to THC. And so you sort of choose how you want to take it, and then you would choose the ratio based on your condition. The second manufacturer has only recently come online. They make only one product right now. It's a tincture, and it's our only a CBD-only product, so it has no THC in it whatsoever. So there are some people who want no THC because they don't want to test positive for a drug test, so they could use this if they wanted to do that.
Okay. And you have one question?
Yeah, I have one question, Randy. I went through your report.
Yes.
And on pages, let me see, 3, 4, and 6, the math is wrong.
So I will say it's not my report, it is the board's report. On what?
Example, if you look on page 6 of that report, they say that 30 milligrams is 3 grams. That's wrong. 30 milligrams is 0.03 grams. So there's a 1,000 fold mistake in this report.
I will look at that. That should be changed. I mean, somebody must have just... we are quite sure of our math and our chemistry, and 30 milligrams per mil is 3%. And 30 milligrams per gram is 3% THC. So that would be.
But they give an example here. 30 milligrams is similar as 2.7 grams, which is not. It's 0.03 grams.
That metric
so
system.
Yeah. Point
I will be sure to go back and check that. And if I can't find what you're talking about, I will contact
you. I blame the metric system. All right. Well, thank you very much. That was very interesting. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Randy.
Okay. So, community and family resources presentation.
Hi, my name is Vanessa Kowalski. I'm a prevention specialist with Community and Family Resources. Basically, my presentation will be very brief. I just want to hand out, I have informational folders. Basically, it just kind of goes over because it's been a while since we had a prevention specialist come to one of the Story County Board of Health meetings. So I just kind of wanted to get my face out there and become available to those who may be seeking services. On the right-hand side of the folder, and I do have extras in case if anyone sitting here would like any as well. But it just kind of goes over our services that we offer. We span in the range of drug-free workplace trainings, Narcan trainings, evidence-based curriculums that we implement into the schools. We offer Prime for Life, which is a diversion program that we do an 8-hour course for in schools. It's kind of like a JDE, a juvenile diversion education program. Instead of kids automatically getting fined or going into the juvenile system or whatever the case may be, it's just an alternative for them. Otherwise, we do offer it as a 12-hour course for DUI, OWI as well. So kind of multi-purpose with that one. Just kind of give an update in regards to the different things that we are working on currently. We are doing the assessment step of the Strategic Prevention Framework model. I'm partnering with the Prevention Policy Coalition for Story County. We finally got all of our materials from the Iowa Department of Public Health, and within our meeting last night, I was able to sit down with coalition members and go through the 12 sectors. We will be conducting a community readiness assessment survey, and we will be focusing on 5 topic areas. Those include adult binge drinking, adult problem gambling, adult prescription medication misuse, youth marijuana use, and youth tobacco use. So working on that, we'll have 30 interviews for Story County, so I'm kind of looking in regards to connections or any contact information if anyone has that they feel would be great to include with that community readiness survey. Please, by all means, send that along to me. But just to kind of wrap up, the only other thing I really have to talk about is in regards to problem gambling. March is known as Problem Gambling Awareness Month, so that'll be something that we'll kind of be promoting and doing presentations within the community, and sending out just additional information on social media and different platforms as that. So that's all I've got.
Thank you very much. Okay, thank you. All right, so next one is Les White with discussion and consideration of the 2020 Community Needs Assessment.
Yeah, this is Les White. I'm the director of Merritt Greeley Home Health Hospice and Story County Public Health. And I just wanted to share with the group where we are in relationship to our 2020 Community Needs Assessment. The Iowa Department of Public Health requires each county to do a countywide needs assessment every 5 years. So this is our year. This will be due to the Iowa Department of Public Health February 2021. So I wanted to just give you a layout of what our plan is. And you may see some of these activities going on in the community, and so this way you can be aware of it. I lead a group. It's called Story County Quality Living Alliance. It is a group of various human services groups within Story County.
And so within that, we have a subcommittee. There's a representative from United Way, from the City of Ames, and YSS, and myself. We have two individuals. We're pretty fortunate to have two retired ISU professors. One specializes in doing focus groups and helping with projects like this. The other one, Les Miller, he focuses on data for us. He used to teach computers and those types of things, computer science at Iowa State. So we really began by saying, well, what is the purpose of the needs assessment? The Iowa Department of Public Health doesn't give you a lot of guidance. Each county can do it however they choose to do it. And we want to make sure when we do it that it is meaningful for everybody. So we came up with, the question is, what are the health and human service needs of Story County and why? Pretty simple. What we did first of all is we sent letters out to various human services groups within Story County, asking them for any data that they had and what were their initial responses in relationship to that question. We got seven different groups back so far. I know there's still a couple others, but we got information and data back from groups like YSS, MICA, United Way. And then Les also took the data from things like the Robert Wood Foundation, the county health rankings. He's looked at data also from the American Community Survey. So he's able to put all that information together and then aggregate it for us. So we started that in September, and then we met here in January. And what came out of that, there was 11 different needs identified. And one of the documents that I know you guys have is a copy, actually, of our next step, which is either a written questionnaire, or we have also included this as a monthly survey type questionnaire. So we are taking the hard copies out to various clinics. As we go and speak to different groups, we'll take hard copies. For those groups that we have contact with, like United Way, their partners, they sent them, Jean sent them an email with the link for the survey. I sent, for instance, my management team and social workers the link to the survey. So we hope to get all of that data back, that our goal is by March 1st. Again, last we'll take that information and aggregate the data and see what we come up with in relationship to what are our top, we'll probably want to focus on our top 3 to 5 needs in Story County. So I will be bringing back the final report. My goal is to have it completed by November, December. So I'll be bringing back our final report at that time. Any questions?
So just clarification, unless I heard you incorrectly, the report is due the end of 2020. It sounded like you said 2021.
I did.
Okay.
I have to get it to the Iowa Department of Public Health by February 2021.
21. Gotcha. And so when do you want the, because I've gotten the emails in regards to having folks complete the assessment.
Sure.
And so when do you want that completed by?
March 1st.
By March 1st.
Because then what we'll do, it'll take us some time to bring that information, get it all aggregated and get those top needs identified. And then we'll also look at what are we going to do with those top needs. And that's part of the report that I send in as well.
And you had mentioned something about having us actually fill out that.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you would like to, either have the hard copy or I'll be happy to, on the hard copy, there's a link that I can send you the link.
I think we've got the link.
Yes. Okay.
I've given it to Stephanie to email.
The hard copy was posted on the agenda. Otherwise, I can send you the link.
Yeah, either or. But we would love to hear from you.
So what we're saying is that this survey, they would like us to fill it out, you know, and give our opinion as one of the groups to fill it out and stuff. Not as a group, but individually.
Right.
Okay. So, right. Great. And you need that by?
March 1st.
Okay.
It's not a long survey, though.
No, it's very short, very quick, to the point. And we thought we'd get a better response that way, and I think
right.
it's really going to show. I did forget to mention the other thing we're going to do is we felt like we get a lot of information from AIMS, related to AIMS. So we are actually going to go out and do focus groups as well. We're going to do a focus group in Collins, Maxwell, and Nevada, and those will be towards the end of February.
So we had a copy of, we were able to see a copy in the minutes of what the questionnaire was, and I saw that, but I kind of have a hard time taking that off and sending it someplace. Is so can we get a copy of that I can send it back
yep.
after I fill it out? Thank you.
That's
it.
Yeah, or you can just go via the link.
Yeah.
I mean, if you go into the link, you can put your name in and do it that way.
Oh, you did?
I forgot to do
it. Oh, you did? Okay. Excellent. Oh, I can go to a SurveyMonkey, too.
That's yeah,
right.
yeah. That's
okay.
what I'm saying. That the link online is
okay.
it's easier because then once you're done, you just hit submit and
it's done.
You don't have to upload and scan and upload
yeah.
anything.
Okay,
yeah.
very good.
Any other questions?
No, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. All right. Discussion and consideration of Environmental Health Department's fee schedule. Marty Baines. Oh, it's not that
one. Sorry.
Just this mic wasn't on. That was one of the problems. Yeah. I'm Margaret James, Environmental Health Department. So every year we just like to present the fee table to the board to see if you want to continue with those fees or change them. The way we write ordinances is so that we don't have to keep changing that ordinance. It just refers back to the board for setting those fees. So currently for a septic permit, $150, and then the soil evaluation, which the department does, is $100, so $250 for everything that you need for a septic. Well permit $125, and then we just, as a favor to DNR, we pick up the extra $25 and just send that to them in one check. We've had the trip fee, $20, and we seldom do that. We want to encourage people to reach out to us, and we go out whenever we're needed, but sometimes people get excessive, and that covers that. And then the radon test kit, $8, that is our cost. We're not making any money on that. So any discussion?
Are those okay? Do you think those fees need to go up, or you think that they're fair, that you're getting what you...
I'm comfortable with them.
Okay.
I don't know. What do you think about radon test kits going up to 10, like a couple bucks just for the runaround that we do, or not? And that, I mean, it's peanuts.
I would just leave
them at cost. Okay. That's okay.
Can I just mention we do have a free radon test kit available today for anybody that wants one that's here because we were doing that for January radon awareness month.
Okay. And then with the septic regulations, if we adopt them, the septic permit and soil evaluation, those will have to change. Okay.
Right.
And then for swimming pools and spas, this we have a contract with IDPH for these. They set them in their ordinance, and therefore, because of the contract, we are held to these numbers. So this is just an FYI. And that's all I have for fees.
You need a motion to approve those fees?
Yes, can't hurt.
Okay, so
yes.
I'd like to, and does any questions about those fees for Margaret? Okay, so I'd like to entertain a motion to approve the fees as presented.
Move, so moved.
Okay. Okay, any further discussion? All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. On the opposed? Nope, okay, sounds good.
Thank you.
Great, okay.
Okay.
And the septic ordinance.
Okay, I'm not sure how to easily go through these changes with you. I mean, we've been working on this for a long time. So what I did on this slide and the next slide, I listed those areas that were tweaked or made major changes, and I'll just go through them. Is that acceptable for all of you? Would that help? Or, and then also the handout that you have there, I left the comments in so that it's just kind of obvious to you which sections we've been keep changing. Currently, we do not have legal's approval. Well, let me go through these and then I'll tell you okay. what I hope to do. Okay. Let's see. Yeah. So in 06-07, we added definitions. And the big ones were the bedroom, the definition of an evaluator designer, and the classification of the waters. And then also abbreviations were added. In 08, we just changed, after all the changes we wanted to make, we landed up listening to people, and we just did two changes in the setbacks, increased them to protect creeks mostly. Individual systems require, except for subdivisions. So this is something that Mark Speck really wanted, the individual systems required for the individual houses, except for subdivisions that allow tanks at each house in a shared system on an outlot owned by an HOA. So out on the farm, lots of families want to have two houses on one system. We're going to try to get away from that. But a lot of the planning and development folks, and then land use approaches, they want to have smaller lots, which is good because you're not eating up all the farmland, and maybe a tank on each lot, and then have one large secondary treatment on an outlot. And so we don't want to stop that from happening. So that's why we can't disallow shared systems for everybody. Then we go into when permits are needed. This is 65.10. So new construction, adding a bedroom, adding home businesses that alters the wastewater volume or strength to greater than what the capacity currently is. And I need to have that one checked by legal just to make sure that they're okay with the business part of that because they didn't like that before. Point 12 through point 14, when a septic permit is needed, when a repair permit is needed, and documents to submit for that. Applications and fees.
One of the things you have talked about in the past was the idea that, is this where it was covered about when these septic systems need to be re-looked at every year or every 5 years?
You every 5 years. That's a little bit further down. Yeah, this is just when somebody has to get a permit for adding a bedroom or something, for example. Point 15, new wastewater generation that is to be directed to an existing system. That's when somebody adds a maintenance shop or somebody builds a house where the original house was burnt down. Point 17 to point 20, the evaluator designer shall conduct reviews, submit detailed plans, and then the sanitarian's reviews of those evaluations. So that's one of the big, big changes is where the county is not going to be doing the evaluations, an engineer or soils professional will be doing those evaluations. In our stakeholder meeting, they didn't like that because it's just easy the way it works now, but they agreed that it's time to go that route, but they were not in favor of going that route, right? Yeah, and thank you for coming, by the way. 21 is subdivisions, 22 soil protection, no complaints there. 23 to 26, permits issued, denial, voiding, expiration of permits. 0.27, certified installer, we did that several years ago, and that is going smoothly. 28, I added holding tanks, just adding a few things that they need to make sure that it doesn't overtop and that they're routinely being pumped. Let's see, 29-30, final inspection. The stakeholders said that they want to be able to cover part of the systems because before we get out there, just for logistics, if you can't get your equipment in there, sometimes you have to backfill as you go, and then weather concerns. So we'll still get a very good inspection on it. It's just that they want to be able to cover up, like, the middle sections of things. Let's see, holding things, final inspection. Certificate of completion, this is new, and this is mostly to just help out the realtors and lawyers. Lots of times when they just need to know that a job was done, and they can have it in their paperwork saying that things were finalized, and we looked at it, and everything is okay. Responsibility, liability, that's just getting us off the hook legally. Again, I'll have Ethan review that. And then this is the one that you were talking about, John. Dr. Passion, point 3.3 is minimum level of septic maintenance required, mandatory pumping every 5 years. This is new to the state of Iowa, less strict than the state requirements for Minnesota. Point 3.4, maintenance contracts.
And this is existing systems or just new systems that fall under this?
Both.
Both. So if I'm living in out in the country and I have a septic system, every 5 years I have to have a pump.
Correct. Yeah. And yes, everyone at the stakeholders said, wow, how are you going to enforce that? And that is our job to figure out, but it's a start. You know, we got to start somewhere.
Got to have it on the books.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. And pretty much people were on board with that, the installers. Maintenance contracts, that just kind of goes over the nitty-gritty and changes when they have to submit those to the department. 3536, NPDES qualified samplers required and duty to mitigate. So those are only the ones that are discharging that would affect the waters of the state that have to be sampled and submitted annually. And you have to be a qualified sampler to do that. And then 41 is variances, and then 43 is a question for you all, effective date. And that's it in a nutshell. So.
Okay. So first of all, does anyone have any questions?
No question, but a comment. Please. I attended that stakeholder meeting, and it was excellent, and I learned everything and more about stuff.
There you go.
She did, yeah.
Well, we know about poop better.
Yes, okay. And I was there as well for part of that meeting.
Yes, thank you.
Found that your stakeholders were very engaged, mm-hmm. and I thought they had some very good comments and the reasoning why something works or doesn't work. Mm-hmm. So, and I appreciate how you kind of commented on that in your notes here with the stakeholders,
okay.
But I like that. Thanks for including that.
They're a good group of people to work with. They really are. Yeah.
Great. So so we have this septic ordinance, and we have to approve it for the Board of Supervisors to put the final approval on, correct?
Correct.
Okay.
So,
it has to go through us first. But what Margaret would request is that if we do approve this, this is pending legal's review of it.
Correct.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And did you say you needed a date or is that?
Yes.
Date.
Well,
because I noticed on your note up here, you put, I think on page 4, 6508, you put, should we make the date January 1, 2021 was your question mark?
Yes. So do you want to have it effective when it... the day it's adopted, or make it a fiscal year startup or a calendar year startup? Does it matter to you?
I like the idea of the fiscal year startup myself.
Fiscal year, so July 1.
Yeah. The only thing I'd say to that is you're in the middle of the construction season, so rules have changed.
There's a good point, Matt.
Maybe January 1st would be a good idea.
What are your kind of thoughts on
huh?
That's the dead part of the season.
It is, but...
So it'll be good to do it.
Yes. So what would you suggest?
Well, I'm thinking to myself, and I'm thinking, that means I'm going to be doing another year of digging. Yeah, so the date is, like if we could adopt it on a... April 1st, or let's see, what is this, February, March, April?
Yeah,
That only gives us a month, so maybe May 1st would be a good...
Does that give enough notification for the folks who are impacted by the changes?
Yeah, I don't know.
That would be my only question, is it would it end up being kind of that gotcha for those folks that, gosh, we didn't, we've been playing by the old rules and now it's changed, so...
There's time with the permit, so they would be informed that they apply for a permit now, wait it for them now, things are going to change. What you're seeing right now on the books is not going to be what the books are when they go to dig in your system. Does that make sense?
And then also, I've told folks, what if we have one pending? And I said, well, if you have submitted your application for a septic, we will do it the old way. And then after that deadline, that line in the sand, that's when they would have to have a soil evaluator do it instead of the county do it.
Okay. May 1st sounds as good a time as any.
Okay.
Okay.
Okay, May 1st.
Okay.
Good.
Great.
Thank you.
So right now we need an approval. Or a motion to approve the septic ordinance as presented to us with the stipulation that legal is going to look at it first, right?
And then if I could reserve the right to review it one more time to get any little typos and this and that out. Nothing substantial, but I plus I have to go through and take out those comments.
Right.
And then put the little index on the top and things like that. Okay. So I need to be able to do that.
Proofreading.
Yes.
Okay, so it needs to be proofread. Okay.
Well, would you rather go for July 1?
Well, that would be fiscal. That would be fiscal, but then...
That'd be the fiscal year.
That would be okay. That would be okay.
Because you have to know...
When do you want to bring it? Let's go backwards. When do you want to present it to the Board of Supervisors? When would you want to go for approval for them?
Yeah. Let's see. I guess it depends on how fast legal can get it to us. As soon as that comes in, I would like to go forward with it. So I would say 2 weeks from now. And it takes three meetings with the Board of Supervisors. You have to have three readings. So that's another 3 weeks. So we're looking at 5 weeks when it'll be finally done.
So I would have no problems accepting a motion for approval pending routine proofreading and the opinion of legal, because so they might make some changes.
You may. Second.
Okay. Any further discussion? And the date of starting would be May 1st.
Or July 1st. May 1st?
Or May 1st.
Okay. Isn't that what you... Did you vote on that initially? Or did you put it out there and somebody... Stephanie, they didn't vote on it when you proposed it? Okay.
No. So, okay.
Okay.
So
May 1st.
The effectiveness, okay. May 1st. Okay. All right. So what we have is we have a motion to approve the septic ordinance with the stipulation that legal will have to go through it, make any legal changes on it, and of course routine proofreading to begin May 1st, 2020. Okay? All right, all those in favor?
Aye.
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 All those opposed? Okay, there you go, got it.
Whew.
Okay.
Really good, thank you.
Thanks for all your work on that. I can just get a lot of work, you guys, on that one, mm-hmm. So good, okay? All right, now we get to talk about the tanning ordinance.
Okay.
This is a lot easier to review.
So, yeah. One slide. So the proposed regulations, so just to remind you, IDPH regulations are still on the books, but they're not going to enforce them. And they've also dropped all the contracts with the counties. Okay. So, it's up to the counties to decide what they want to do, and if you want to enforce that, then you have to have something on your books. So we went through and pretty much adopted the state regulations and then took out all of the references to IDPH and then their fee schedules and things like that. And then, so the only two changes then, of course, are the inspection fees, and they will be set by the Board of Health. And actually, that's something that we'll need to do today if you adopt this. And then no one under the age of 18 will be allowed to use a tanning device as it's described in the proposed ordinance. So if mom and dad own a tanning bed, the kiddos can tan themselves. But it's the ones that we are enforcing these regulations on. There cannot be an 18-year-old. Now, with this, we did not have a stakeholders meeting. And Kathy came up with the idea that before we present this to the Board of Supervisors, we would send down a letter describing what's going on to those stakeholders, owners of these beds, for example. And hopefully they will attend the Board of Supervisors meeting and share their input. Because the 18 thing, that is going to cut in on some of their business, the prom kids, for example. And then this map shows that there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, only 6 states, that 7, that don't have any regulations on age for tanning beds. Iowa does not. So again, Story County, I believe this is another first in our state for making more stringent regulations on this. Some of the things that I've read, the impact, like if a 50-year-old and a 16-year-old went in and did tanning, it would be the same effect. But the 16-year-old, same exposure, 16-year-old has different ideas on what looks cool, and decision-making is not, you know, the best at that kind of thing. So that's the big push. That's why it's an 18 cutoff. And exposure at a younger age leads to cancer problems. Yeah. So then the only other thing, did you review the appendix?
Yeah.
The appendix and that list of medications?
Yeah. So the way that I understand that ordinance, they're supposed to kind of screen for that and let people know that they may tan more because of it?
Mm-hmm. Or okay. Burn more.
Or burn more.
Yeah.
There's a list of medications and creams and things that you can use that will make you more prone to have, you know, photosensitivity reaction. That's what it's called. And again, I kind of like how you stated in that, or how the regulations state, that not all people who are using these things will respond with a photosensitivity reaction, but they could.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, yeah.
And that's all I have. So then.
Okay. So do you need an approval for that tanning ordinance?
Yes, and or a recommendation to the Board of Supervisors.
Okay. Yeah. So, any further questions at all?
Yeah, I think it's an excellent idea to have a stakeholders meeting.
Yeah.
Do you want a separate one?
Do you want that before we approve it? Do you want a stakeholders meeting before we approve it, or do you want us to approve it and then have a stakeholders meeting letting them know that this is going to go in front
yes.
of the Board of Supervisors?
Yeah.
That, or have the stakeholders meeting pretty much during the Board of Supervisors, like, you know, when the first, second, and third readings, that is the public's opportunity to comment on them.
Right.
And that is when they could bring their concerns up about this.
But do you want one before that?
Yeah.
Part?
Okay. Okay, we can.
Yeah.
We certainly can.
I think that's
the
reasonable.
The reason is because I found out even with the septic tank stakeholders meeting, a lot of questions are brought up by the individual
mm-hmm.
parties
mm-hmm.
that are really
yeah.
good.
Okay.
To consider.
Good point.
So
yeah.
I think the same would be true for this.
I have
okay.
no problems with that. Okay.
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 So we will set that up and then re-present it the next Board of Health meeting.
Yeah.
Does that work?
Right.
Okay.
I think
we'll
that would be great. Thank
Any
you.
Other things you want to see included with this regulation?
If we're taking this over, do we want to leave that fee at $5? That's kind of ridiculous. I mean, we can't run a piece of paper for $5.
Oh, that's a good point.
Well, I didn't quite hear that.
That's
a state.
That's a state.
Yeah.
Yeah,
we
that's
want
what
them
they
to
put in. But if we're doing all of this, why?
The way the regulation is set up, the state is the one that permits all of those places. But they don't have the money or personnel to do any inspections unless they get a complaint. So we're basically taking their ordinance and taking out their role as far as monies go. And the one major thing we're adding is the age requirement.
And that's what
Does
I was going to say
sense?
About the stakeholders meeting. This is already regulations that they've been since, I don't know how long that regulation, we just basically copied the state code, put it in ours, and added the 18.
The age.
But that's going to be a big thing.
That's going to be a big thing.
I think you're going to get a lot of pushback from them, because what they're going to ask for is permission from the parent.
Yep.
They will.
Yeah.
They will.
Okay, we'll do that.
But that's something we just want the supervisors to hear. I think them speaking directly to the supervisors is better than having a meeting where they're speaking to us and we,
have no power, really. Yeah.
We're just suggesting it.
And because that's what's different from the septic. In the septic, the reason we had a lot of questions at the stakeholders is because there's a lot of changes between what the state is offering and what we're at.
Mm-hmm.
But our main difference, as Matt said, is the age requirement.
Mm-hmm.
So it depends, I guess, on...
So you think it's going to be, if we do a stakeholder meeting, what you're telling me is that if we do a stakeholder meeting, the major thing they're going to talk about is the 18-year thing.
That's the only thing they're probably going to talk about.
And then we're going to say, well, that's what we're going to propose. And they go, well, why are you having this meeting with us?
Exactly. They need to say what their opinions to the Board of Supervisors.
Because they'll be able to change.
Because otherwise it's just us taking down notes and presenting it.
Got it.
To you and the supervisors. Why be the middleman and let them just talk directly to the supervisors?
Right, and you could potentially represent the exact same thing to us and just say, we want to keep it at this, but the pushback was the age requirement.
Yeah. We pretty much know that.
Oh, yeah, I know.
Yeah.
I was going to say, yeah. So what do you think? You think it might be I think what is brought up from the staff is reasonable, that if they do have this stakeholder meeting, that it will be a little bit different than the septic ordinance. Because the biggest thing is going to be 18, and we've already made that decision. So they're going to come back with us with something, and we're going to say, well, we disagree with you. But the Board of Supervisors has the option to actually overrule us, because we're just an advising consent board, as I've been told time and time and time.
And we can do a good job, letting them know all the details. We'll send out information packets to... I don't know how many stakeholders there will be with that.
There's probably about 20 sites in town that we know of.
Okay, so 20-ish.
So maybe the better option is, after you bring that up, that we just approve this as written and then make sure that they're alerted to the facts, so if they wish to.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And again, contingent on legal review,
right.
And
exactly.
One more
and
proofreading. Yes.
Okay.
You
great.
Always find one more little.
So I will entertain a motion to approve the tanning ordinance with the stipulation that legal approval and proofreading.
So moved.
Second. Okay. All right. Any further discussion? Okay. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed. Okay, great, and it passes. I kind of like only having to look one way.
I'm ex officio.
You're ex officio. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, now we go on to our Story County Public Health Report.
Hi, I'm Teresa Ferrari with Story County Public Health. So we've been busy with the coronavirus thing going, lots of questions, lots of people calling in, wondering, my husband came back from China, what do we do, just because there's a lot of Chinese people here in Ames. And Sherry, in fact, is at a webinar, watching a webinar right now. I don't know if there's been any major changes, I kind of doubt it, but, we're level 4, and so anyone traveling to Wuhan is mandatory, am I saying that right, Wuhan, China,
mm-hmm.
is mandatory 14 days in isolation. And then if you've been in China, in the surrounding areas, then it's isolation, but it's more just self-quarantine. And then people, someone monitoring you, making sure you don't have any symptoms. But
so someone traveling from Wuhan and they come here to Des Moines,
fly into Des Moines,
right,
then they have to be isolated for 14 days.
Mm-hmm. It's mandatory. Yeah. It says anyone returning from or from, well, actually, it's not, is it? Well, Hubei province, which I think that's where that city is at, will be subject to 14 days of mandatory quarantine to provide proper medical care and health screening.
Now, will that happen from Des Moines? Because virtually everybody who flies into Des Moines from right. another country has gone through another airport. Or will this happen in customs in Chicago, customs in San Francisco?
That
or will it be up to us in Des Moines to do it?
Right.
Do we know that?
I don't know the answer to that question.
Well, I guess they have to look at their ticket to know.
Well, that's what they would do. Yeah, that,
you
right.
know, you could fly into Atlanta or the Twin Cities,
mm-hmm.
and then you're going to get a flight.
But this is a national
4 hours
thing.
Later.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is a national thing.
Okay, right.
So, mm-hmm. so really, when they come into the country, so it's the port of entry that should be doing
Yeah,
this.
That's where it should be done at.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Gotcha. So. Right.
And then they would probably inform. I mean, we're notified. We would be, if it would be in the Ames area, notified by IDPH, and, you know, it would trickle. They're kind of our boss, or they are our boss, and something comes in, then we'll be notified from them and mm-hmm. that type of thing. But, so, yeah, that's the big news. And I don't know if today if they've just – I haven't heard on the news.
Do we know how bad this is, like how bad of a disease this is yet? Because on my things that I'm reading, I'm having a hard time understanding how bad this is. Or is it just that it broke out in a city of 11 million people?
Right.
You know,
and I think
flu kills a bunch of people, too.
Right.
So I don't know how bad this is. Do we know yet?
From what I'm being told, it's not as bad as what the media makes it seem like. It's less than they don't know exactly everything about it, obviously. But what they know so far, it seems less than what SARS was.
SARS, yeah.
Yeah, it doesn't seem as bad. But
okay.
And there's now 11 cases in the United States. We'll probably get more, but as long as we keep it contained and everyone, you know, the people freak out, but it's just washing hands and covering cough and just, you know, like your typical trying to prevent the flu. And so I don't know. It'll be interesting to see how it ends up. But and yesterday I talked on the KHOI radio. And that was kind of the wrong day to be there. It was kind of a zoo with a caucus, but they didn't plan that very well. But anyway, I taped, and but Keith Morgan was with me, and we just did a tape about the coronavirus. And
great.
So you could listen to the, I don't know what days I'll be on the radio, but I'm on the radio there. And then I wanted to say, too, our hospital has developed a screening. I was just reading Leanne, our infectious control nurse over there, she had this is what the hospital, anyone that comes into the hospital is asking, like, have you been in contact with someone who has been sick? And do you have a fever, cough, or shortness of breath, difficulty breathing? Have you traveled internationally in the last month? And if yes, select the location from a drop-down list. You know, this is what they do when they admit people into the hospital, drop-down list, and then indicate the dates of travel. And if the patient has symptoms and traveled to China within the past 14 days, a BPA, what's that stand for? A BPA will fire directing your next steps.
It's just something in the computer that fires to tell you what you need to do next. Like, they'll need to contact contact infection control, they'll contact the Iowa Department of Public Health. Of course, a physician will be involved. So it's just something that the computer fires to let them know what their next steps are. We are also doing this in home health and home hospice before we go into the homes with any of our new clients, just to make sure that we are safe. Because we do quite a few... we have quite a few clients from Iowa State, and so we're doing this screening for them as well.
Okay.
Yeah, I hear Tammy asking every time she's getting someone registered for it. But so just a little update on the flu, influenza, which you know, it's kind of crazy how we all freak out about this. I know the coronavirus is unknown, but the flu, the latest is CDC estimates that so far this season there have been at least 19 million flu illnesses, and this is just in the United States, 180,000 hospitalizations and 10,000 deaths from the flu.
Do we have a child, a pediatric count?
Huh?
Do we have a pediatric count?
You know, the last I looked, I didn't get one. I was like close to 200. It was like 160-some. That's been a few weeks ago.
That's a lot.
Yeah.
That's a real lot.
Yeah, it was.
Because usually it's about 80.
Because I get, every Friday I get the flu. It was quite a bit. I mean, every time, every week there was more added to it. I didn't look at that last. I haven't looked at that lately. So I'll get back to you on that and see what.
Yeah, I can.
Because it always says. But yeah, it's been. But that's what's so interesting is that everyone's worried about this, and then only like 40%, if that. I don't even know if 40% people get the flu shot. You know. So anyway.
How many hospitalizations did you say there was? I'm sorry.
180. And this was the last CDC report just the other day. And then we've had, you know, it was the influenza B initially. Now it's kind of starting to see more A. And there was an outbreak at some long-term care facility in Ames just last week. Nick called us. That means an outbreak is two. And I think that's all they ended up having was influenza A. But we haven't heard that any more people got it.
And I heard that the match for B is not good, but the match for A is good. Is
that correct? I haven't heard that. And the last I saw, this says, I mean, this just came off the flu thing this last Friday. It said flu vaccine effectiveness is not yet available this season. But you hear different things from different places. But this came from the CDC.
Yeah, this, yeah. And unfortunately, we don't get good data until after it's all over.
Yeah.
That's right. After the horse.
Everywhere you look, you see different things. But I always try to, I think CDC is a good. But they just said it's not sure yet. The end of the month, we're doing a pod exercise with our 1B coalition. Just the whole 1B coalition, each of our counties are doing our own little pod exercise for practice, just as a deliverable for the coalition.
Okay.
So that'll be the end of the month. But any questions?
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Okay. And the YSS Denise Denton report. did a baby die of marijuana?
You would like that or not, like that as a female. So, Denise Denton, YSS. So, we have good news and we have bad news. The good news is both task force that I'm involved in and Vanessa is involved in, the opioid task force in Story County Opioid Task Force and the Nevada Substance Abuse Task Force. After kind of a short reprieve, are back up and running, and both of them are looking at their next steps at this point. So if you recall, the Opioid Task Force did a series of community conversations which ended last January and really have been sort of dormant since, looking at what next steps are. The Nevada Task Force did a town hall meeting in November. They met again on Monday, and they're looking at what they can do about vaping at this point. So their last one was about alcohol, in part because we had grant money to address that specifically. But one of the things that they are concerned about is vaping in the schools right now. And so that was part of the conversation about, you know, how would you go about convincing kids not to do silly things. So we'll be looking at, one of the things that we talked about was having other peers come in and talk about that, kids who are in leadership groups who have looked at this issue. And one of those that was talked about was the Mayor's Youth Committee, because they were involved in passing the vaping ordinance in Story County. So that's something that will be going forward. Other good news is that, to my knowledge, at the last opioid meeting, there were no deployments of Narcan recently. That doesn't mean there weren't overdoses, but there weren't obvious overdoses, I guess.
So, and of course, you may or may not know that Narcan is not freely given out now, that you need to go through a pharmacist, but it is still available to anyone who would want it. So,
how expensive is it?
About $150 to $75 for two deployments, a twofer package.
And you were giving, guys were giving it out.
So it can be well worth the money in the long run, but not cheap either. So the other good news concerning opioids, I think, is I may or may not have shared with this group that last early summer I was contacted by an advocacy group out of Washington, D.C. called Voices for Opioid Choices. And they were looking to try and forward some legislation that would make alternatives to opioids available. At this point, if you leave the hospital, Medicare or Medicaid will pay for 30 days of something. And so that is what is done. It is just easily available. This group was looking to promote funding for alternatives to that. So could doctors not prescribe and it be covered by insurance, other alternatives such as physical therapy, yoga, acupuncture, other, there was a medication too that the name escapes me. So I worked with these folks to give them some information about what we had been doing in Story County and what that looked like. And they eventually asked me to go to Senator Ernst's office and talk to her staff about it. Not to advocate because I can't do that. And he did say, the staffer said, oh yeah, that's what everybody says. And I said, well, in my case, I don't know the name of the bill. I'm not really involved in that. But here's what I know about opioids and here's what I know about alternatives. So the good news is, and I don't think I'm responsible for this. I think there were many people in play. But Senator Ernst was one of the sponsors of a bipartisan bill that has now been forwarded in the House, and there is one in the Senate, called the No Pain Act, that would support insurance coverage of alternatives to opioids.
Take so credit for it.
Okay. No. They did ask me to come to D.C. and go to the Hill with their folks the first week in December, and the first week of December is right before finals, so that was never going to happen. But Tasha Taronis did, and she's somebody who's on the opioid task force and lost her daughter to an opioid overdose. So she would have been a much more compelling individual to talk with those legislators, and I think she must have done a good job because it was very soon after that that they made that announcement. So that's exciting. And it's, you know, it takes a long time to get a bill through Congress, but it's a first step. So that's encouraging. The stuff that is not so encouraging is you have several articles concerning cannabis. And, you know, I know, Dr. Passion, you often say that there's just no research to back up a lot of this information. And I thought you would find this one article interesting because it is from somebody who does cover this sort of thing, talking about how it is very difficult to get out the information that they do find, that she covers this. But when she forwards it to other publications, she finds that, again, people who are trying to make money squelch that information, and so much of the research does not get out to people. And another author that I've just recently reread his book talked about how no one called for an interview for his book. He got it was covered by other countries where they are doing this sort of research, but he had not one review because people don't want to hear the bad news. It's sort of like with big tobacco. Big marijuana has a huge lobby about this, and they don't like to hear bad news about it. So same thing with vaping. You know, there's a lot of money behind it. So I thought that was interesting. But in terms of research, I gave you an article about 2 million heart disease patients and the kind of what we are seeing in research in terms of what it does do to the heart, which I found this very interesting. You know, I started looking at this topic in earnest about 18 years ago and have read research pretty much every day since. And I have known for a long time that it increases the heart rate by about 50% within the first hour. So this didn't come as a huge surprise to me. But again, it's like, why don't other people know that? Why doesn't this get out as much as it does? And, you know, hallucinogens are sort of famous for that. Hallucinogens are like what I always call bipartisan drugs. So they have one real job, which is distort perception. That's why they get out of bed in the morning, have a cup of coffee, and go to work. But they also borrow, and so many hallucinogens will also ramp up your heart rate while you feel like you're moving really slow. So it's sort of a trifecta in a bad way.
But so I found that interesting, and also the information that's coming out about what it's doing prenatally. And they are seeing a huge uptick in mothers who are using smokable marijuana in Colorado. 60 Minutes or 2020 did an episode on that last year where they talked about what they are seeing, but mothers are nauseous, so they think that's a good way to go about that. And of course, anything you smoke is not going to be good for a fetus. Back me up on that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think I'm making that one up. Last but not least is an article, and another one out of Washington that speaks to a more long-term study that AAA did about driving in Washington State, which was one of the first states that legalized it. They went 5 years before and 5 years after to look at what they saw in terms of car crashes. And they don't make any claims that the THC is totally responsible for that, but all of those people tested positive for THC in those crashes. So the last one is, again, you always hear about how there's really no long-term research about vaping. And so I did find an article that speaks to that. And one of the things that you've been hearing about the vaping illnesses, I think this article speaks to a number that needs to be updated. The last number I saw for vaping illnesses was a couple of weeks ago. It was 2,268 with 60 deaths. So that's been going steadily up. And this speaks to that. It also speaks to the fact that most adult vapers also continue to use cigarettes, conventional cigarettes, so that's wearing on them as well. And it also speaks to the fact that a lot of the young people who are using it are vaping THC, and so that's probably not a good thing either. There was something else in this I was going to mention. Anyway, for your reading pleasure, it's all pretty much bad news on the downside of this, but what questions do you have?
So Denise, I have a question.
Sure.
So I don't know if I saw this like an ad on TV or if I like dreamt it. Quite honestly, I just don't remember. But I think it was an ad. Lack of sleep the last few days or whatever. So do you do through like YSS like some education of kids? Because if I'm recalling this ad correctly, it talked about like different, you know, talking to your kids in different materials that would look pretty innocent but actually are vaping
materials. Right. There's hundreds and hundreds of different models.
Right. So
styles.
What extent through your program do you talk to young folks, or do young folks part of your presentation talk about what they've used or how they've tried to hide that they've been vaping?
Well, we do have that yet. A program called In Plain Sight.
Uh-huh.
That we can do. Usually you do it with parents, though, because it's like these are all the things that you look at your kid's room and you go, looks like a kid's room in here.
Right.
When in fact, a lot of it is paraphernalia. You don't usually show kids how to hide paraphernalia.
Sure.
That would be, counterproductive.
No. I meant, did you have?
But do you talk to kids about that?
Right.
Yes, and
right.
We do. And I am not the vaping person per se, but I did go to the middle school right before the holidays with our person who does that to talk about substance abuse. We spent most of that time talking about how do you say no to that,
right,
should
right.
somebody offer it to you. But he did point that out, and we did talk a little bit about the vaping illness. Along those lines, I wanted to tell you just an anecdote before I forget it. I had a student come up to me last week sometime and say, can I talk to you about something? He was practically in tears, and I thought, this is not going to be pretty. So we arranged to meet in my office the next morning, and I said, what can I do to help you? And he said, I want to talk about addiction. Okay. He said, I started vaping when I came to Iowa State. You know, you come to college and you think you should do something sort of radical, and so I started vaping. And I did that for about 2 years. And I quit for about 2 weeks last summer, and then, of course, I came back to school and started again. He said, but I recently quit. And I threw up every morning for 2 weeks. I lost 15 pounds. And he said, and now I can't quit. He said, I am so anxious every morning. I just wake up in a cold sweat. And he said, I've never done that before in my life. And I think that's what it's from. And I said, why do you think you quit? And he said, well, first of all, I wasn't getting anything from it. And he was using pods that were 50 milligrams. He said, and I realized I was spending a lot of money. And I realized I'm a community and public health major. So all those things came together, and he had an aha moment. But he really is suffering. I met with him again this morning, and I said, how is that going? And he said, oh, I still wake up. And he said, and it tapers off. But it, I mean, it sounds like a huge nicotine withdrawal. People go through that when they go through withdrawal from nicotine. But it doesn't usually last this long. I thought that was very interesting. Of course, you don't have 50 milligrams of nicotine in your system when you smoke a conventional cigarette either. Not even close. And he said that to me. He goes, it's just so much. Who does that? I said, well, you did. And this may be, I'd not heard of that before, but that's been very interesting to me. So I asked him this morning if I could share that with you. I said, I, of course, won't say your name or anything like that, but I thought that was very interesting.
Has anyone seen any e-cigarettes in movies?
In what?
Movies.
Yeah.
There have been e-cigarettes?
No, I don't think that I have.
Of course,
because I know there's a big discussion about taking cigarettes out of movies.
Right.
And but I'm wondering, I don't go to the movies a lot, but I can't think of a movie where e-cigarettes are seen.
I don't think I've seen, and I go to a fair amount with my son, but I don't think I have seen.
Knives Out didn't have it. I think someone was smoking. A few people were smoking in Knives Out.
Yeah,
I see movies with marijuana in them, but I don't see e-cigarettes.
No, but I did see somebody on campus using it this morning.
Someone?
I said I did see somebody on campus this morning as I was leaving. I couldn't get to her in time. So,
Wow. Okay. Well, all right. Well, thank you very much.
Okay. One more thing. The Health Promotion Club and Prevention Policy Board and Healthiest Ames have sent yet another letter to the legislators encouraging them to pass legislation that would take it out of public spaces and to come in alignment with the new federal regulation that says that, you know, nobody under 21. So hopefully they will do something about that. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. All right. Story County Environmental Health Report.
Margaret James, Environmental Health, Story County. I'll make this fast. I realize that it's kind of getting late. Okay, so well activity for fiscal year 2020. Seven pluggings, zero cisterns, three well rehabs, and 66 water samples. And we've spent spent about $10,000 of our grant money so far with $21,000 remaining. And we have had 17 total well permits issued. We had a confrontation with DOT. They decided that they could plug their own well. They hired one of their folks. And if you remember, this project was just rife with problems. Well, this was probably one of the last problems that we ran into. They went ahead and had the contractor plug the well. They weren't certified, so I went through DNR and that. And we went out and saw, and they actually did plug it wrong, so they had to dig up the thing, cut out the casing. So, but now it's been done right, and hopefully DOT has learned their lesson to not assume that they get to call all the shots. This one, how does this even belong here? Well, Kathy went out to do, we had a request for a water test, and so she went out, and lo and behold, there are 3 dozen or so Pomeranians.
There were at least three, she was a breeder.
A breeder, yeah.
There were at least 3 dozen of these little things. They're in cages.
So we turned this over to planning and development because they do not have a business permit, a home business permit. So, yeah. So, and then to follow up with that, so these guys get all the good calls, not me. So this one, Matt got a call on, surprise, abandoned well at the Nevada Pharmacy. So right here in town. So go ahead and tell them, Matt.
They had a sewage backup, and it was all wood floor in the basement. And they had a company come in to clean that up, and they decided just to rip out the whole floor. And one of the guys was standing, walking across the floor, and fell through, and the floor joist stopped him from falling all the way through.
How deep is that?
He had a 12-foot pole that he reached out with and touched water.
Wow. Pretty close to the surface.
4 or 5 foot down to the water. It's kind of hard to tell when that happened. If he would have been there alone, he would have never gotten. And he wasn't at work the next day because he was a little sore. You can imagine how the floor goes down.
Oh, okay, I understand.
So, yeah, so next good call, I get you guys. Septics for calendar year 2020, let's see, so you can just read that table. And then I just wanted to point out, so for calendar year 2019, we caught up with 18, coming in at 91. So it was a slow year for a while, and then bam, we caught up. The picture here shows what happens when you use less than the required Schedule 40 plastic, cracks like crazy. Complaints, another sewage backup in a Nevada apartment, and I continue working with the owner to remove a trailer on a November complaint that we received. I think I'm going to have to start sending them a notice of violation because their attorney claimed that they never even heard of this problem. And then we got a call on erosion on the Skunk River at the Kenmero Bridge near Southdale, and this one I just turned over to Darren Engineering, but it's nice to know that the different departments, you know, have eyes and ears open for each other. So they're probably going to end up having to remove this bridge eventually, I would imagine. Conceptual reviews for Ballard Golf and Country Club and Isaac Walton League. Trainings and meetings, Iowa DNR Field Office Fives, Civility in the Workplace, Stephanie and Kathy. And then Matt also went to a well program recently. For miscellany, IWWA's Coyotes test rewrite, I'm still working on that with the group. Construction evaluation resolution was passed by the Board of Supervisors. They do that every year. That just gets us able to do the master matrix reviews. So every year they have to pass that. Another thing is Crestview has been in contact with us again, and it looks like they're going to be filling in that lagoon, and so have to work with him on trying to figure out wastewater treatment for that one existing house. So we'll see how that comes out. And then I wanted to just give a shout-out to Kathy and Stephanie for doing this excellent job on this radon thing, and the radon, you know, sent out a bunch of emails and tweets and whatever you do. So really good. Got the word out. And I want to say thank you. So this is, I had to just share this. I went to Costa Rica, and this is a sloth holding her baby. That little brown thing in the middle is her baby. He way up in the tree. This was through a scope using a camera. So yeah, so very cool. But thank you. Any questions?
Thank you very much.
Okay, that's it.
Okay, so any comments? Now we're at the comments section. Any comments from our staff? Oh, comments from board? Ex officio. Comments? Okay, I have no comments, so this meeting is adjourned. Thank you all very much.